And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and streaming online at freakradio.org. Today we're talking about the situation in Syria. Pro-democracy protests spread across Syria early last year after Syrian security forces fired on unarmed demonstrators in the southern city of Daraa. Resistance to the Syrian regime began as a nonviolent movement, but after severe repression by government forces, civilians and army defectors began forming fighting units which unified under the banner of the Free Syrian Army. The United Nations estimates that since the uprising began 14 months ago, more than 9,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed in Syria and tens of thousands displaced. Syria has been suspended from the Arab League, while the European Union and the United States have imposed sanctions. Although military intervention has so far been ruled out by Western nations, there have been increasing calls to arm the opposition. International pressure on the Syrian government has further intensified in the past few days after a massacre in the town of Hula on Friday that left over 100 people dead, including 49 children and 34 women. The UN Security Council called an emergency session on Sunday, and its members unanimously supported a statement condemning the killings and blaming the Syrian regime. At first, Russia, a staunch Syrian ally, blamed both sides for the massacre, but Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently stated that the Assad regime was primarily to blame for the last 15 months of carnage in Syria. Meanwhile, UN envoy Kofi Annan traveled to Syria for talks, and the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, told Fox News on Monday that the escalating atrocities in Syria could potentially result in a military intervention. Joining us by phone tonight to discuss the uprising in Syria is Dr. Stephen Zunes, one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action, and a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. Dr. Zunes also serves as a senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies, and is chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
I want to start off by asking you to, you recently wrote an article that appeared in the Huffington Post stating that you oppose military intervention in Syria, and I'm wondering if recent events in the town of Hula change your thoughts on military intervention.
Well, not at all. In fact, if anything, it reinforces it, because it's been the limited armed resistance that in many ways has given the Syrian regime the excuse to launch massive shelling and other attacks into civilian neighborhoods. And it has helped to solidify the support for the regime, you know, by having this kind of armed resistance. And of course, if you had brought in foreign troops, that would make things even worse. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with a ruthless regime like that of Assad, people are going to die when they try to resist to overthrow it. But history has shown that armed resistance ends up getting a lot more people killed and is not necessarily more effective. Statistically, largely nonviolent uprisings against authoritarian regimes are more than twice as likely to succeed as predominantly armed struggles. Assad is different. I mean, the pro-democracy movement in Syria, and talk about the original movement, the nonviolent movement, which is still very strong despite the simultaneous armed resistance. The nonviolent movement and the pro-democracy movement in Syria is as sincere and legitimate and indigenous as the pro-democracy movement against Ben Ali in Tunisia and Mubarak in Egypt, Saleh in Yemen, King Hamad, and Bahrain. You know, it's very similar to the movements that challenge these U.S.-backed dictatorships. The problem is with Syria is that the regime still has something of a social base, a minority at this point. They certainly alienated a lot of people, but it's not just one-man rule like those other four cases. It is more of an oligarchy. This guy isn't like a Mubarak or Gaddafi or somebody who's just or Assad. You know, kind of runs everything. You have a very powerful party, the Ba'ath Party, which has been in power for close to 50 years. And they have party offices in virtually every town and neighborhood. They have a crony capitalist class, which has enriched itself due to its close ties to the regime. You have the military, which has largely run the country, that has a strong stake in the system. You have religious minorities who have been co-opted in a sinister divide and rule policy, not just the Alawites, from which Assad and a lot of the ruling elites are from, but also Christians, Druze, others, who feel they have a stake in the regime. So in other words, it's not just kind of one guy who's alienated everybody. It's a regime that has enough of support. This is going to be a tough nut to crack, you know, whether it's violent or nonviolent, whether people do it on their own or there is foreign intervention. And one of the big strengths of the current regime in Syria is they have successfully played the nationalist card, that they see themselves as the last surviving bastion of secular Arab nationalism, you know, which had been so prominent and in many ways dominated the Arab world for many years, but they're the last ones.
So you're arguing that a military intervention would strengthen the regime and actually make things far worse.
Oh yeah, very, very much so. I mean, in fact, historically, when there has been a foreign military intervention, even in these so-called humanitarian kind of situations, it's generally increased the killings. I mean, we saw this in Libya. We saw this in Serbia in 1999. And I think it would be even more so. I mean, at this point, the regime would have nothing to lose, and they'd unleash even greater oppression. It would get people who are kind of wavering in terms of who to support to back the regime, because it would no longer be this, you know, seen as this pro-democracy struggle against this this repressive dictatorship, but a struggle of the country against foreign invaders. And this is the real problem. Also, of course, you know, you got to wonder about the sincerity of the United States and some of these other countries about freedom and democracy, given that we support these horrific dictatorships in that part of the world. And ironically, the U.S. has been quite willing to work with Assad in some things, like extraordinary rendition. We have sent terrorist suspects to Damascus to be brutally tortured, including, you may recall, this incident of a Canadian citizen who was wrongly identified, and the U.S. Captured him when he was just changing planes at the Kennedy Airport and sent to Damascus, where he was tortured for the better part of a year. We initially supported Syria and Lebanon to crush the leftist Lebanese national movement. We supported them when they staged a coup to back a pro-Iraqi prime minister back in 1990, and then we turn around and complain that, oh dear, Syria is dominating Lebanon. That shows how evil they are. I could go on, but you know, the United States and many other Western powers have virtually no credibility when they talk about freedom and democracy in the Middle East. So we're still the number one backer of dictatorships, and so this, of course, would play right into Assad's hands. Look, you know, you guys don't. This is about democracy. This is about U.S. imperialism and hegemony. In certain ways, he'd be right.
Certainly something has to be done. If it's not military intervention, then what? I mean, pretty much so far what has been done is words. I mean, there's been the UN supervision mission in Syria, but that seemed to be relatively useless. I mean, the fact that they were there to document the massacre in Hula is important, but other than that, what have they accomplished, and what would you recommend?
Well, the presence of the mission and the ceasefire agreement, though it's certainly been broken, did some good in that the violence until this very recent thing a couple of days ago had been reduced relative to the levels immediately beforehand. And it gave the first day or two when it seemed to be holding, you had literally millions of Syrians out in the streets in these peaceful pro-democracy struggle demonstrations. So it did provide a little bit of space. But ultimately, I mean, the best case scenario I see for Syria would be something comparable to what we saw in South Africa during the apartheid era, that a combination of largely nonviolent resistance, as they had in the townships, combined with targeted international sanctions, could create a situation, as in South Africa, where you have the white capitalist class going to the white minority regime and basically saying, hey guys, the gig is up. We can't survive this way, the disruption of the economy from the internal protests and the strikes and the boycotts and general chaos, combined with these international sanctions, is destroying the economy, and we just cannot survive. You got to release Mandela, legalize the ANC, and start negotiations for majority rule. And we see a similar situation in Syria, because the Alawites are about the same percentage of the population as whites.
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, it's a minority regime, like the whites in South Africa, who use certain segments of the Zulus and other minorities and divide and rule. But ultimately, when you have most of the population up in an uprising like this, you're going to, it's unsustainable in the long term. And so that really, I think, is the best solution.
It would
really
be the best solution, but how likely is it?
More likely than the other scenario I can think of, because again, the armed struggle is again. I don't make moral judgments against Syrians or South Africans or anybody who feel that they need to take up arms against severe oppression. But just in terms of tactically, strategically, armed struggle in this case is meeting the regime at its strongest point, where they have the firepower, where they have the professional elite forces, where you're having large scale defections in the military when the movement was overwhelmingly nonviolent. But since some segments of the movement have taken up arms, these defections have slowed to a trickle.
Though it's certainly understandable that there was arms taken up after. This is not the first massacre that's taken place. I mean, several other major.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm not making moral judgments at all. But the problem is also with arms struggle, is you start getting some pretty sketchy involved. I mean, we're already seeing groups that seem to be affiliated with Al Qaeda and others, getting involved, and we've seen this historically. That arms struggle. Let's just contrast it. Nonviolent struggles, like we're seeing in Syria, are usually made of these broad-based civil society organizations, popular committees, democratically run, that have a broad, that bring in broad segments of society together. It's a democratic process. It's a relatively pluralistic process. But armed struggle is based on this idea of an elite vanguard. Very, very hierarchical, as military organizations by their nature, tend to be. And, usually made up exclusively of young, able-bodied men, unlike these broader popular struggles that have a large percentage of women and people of all ages and the like. And this idea of power coming from the barrel of a gun, creates a more of an authoritarian a structure with a strict military hierarchy and martial values. And historically, we've seen time and time again, and there are exceptions in both directions, but on average, dictatorships overthrown by nonviolent struggles tend to evolve into stable democracies within a few years, whereas dictatorships overthrown through armed struggle, the vast majority of the time, end up being another dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the part of the issue, of course, is what the future of Syria is going to be like. I mean, I don't think one can realistically hope that at this stage the armed struggle will stop completely. But I think the key is that the civil insurrection, the largely nonviolent popular movement, will continue, and we have seen that so far, which gives me some hope, because again. No regime can survive with this kind of disruption, with this many people rising up against it, and this kind of growing international isolation.
Yeah, but there's already been sanctions in place, and the nonviolent resistance has been going on since early last year. I mean, how long is that going to take? How many more people have to die in the meantime? I mean, what you're proposing isn't anything new, right? It's basically a continuation of the status quo, that there'll be sanctions in place and people will continue to protest. And you're saying that eventually it will just become too disruptive?
Yeah, that really is the most realistic.
So you're not saying that anything new, there's nothing the international community, for example, could do?
I do think there can be some additional targeted sanctions. I think there can be I would like to, you know, to see a greater, you know, in NGO involvement. I get nervous about foreign governments getting involved, but various NGOs, international solidarity work, and the like, in support of the opposition. But I think eventually, again, it's Syria, like I say, there's certain combinations which make Syria tough enough to crack. Now, if I believed that armed struggle would be more effective and would bring an end to the suffering quicker, and you know, I would certainly be willing to say this. I'm not taking a pacifist position here. I'm taking this as a, you know, from a position of a strategic analyst who knows something about about Syria. But I really don't see a realistic scenario where armed struggle would reduce the suffering or shorten the amount of time before Assad and his clique are finally overthrown.
Do you think statements, for example, as I mentioned, from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, are going to be at all effective in influencing Syria, or is that just more words?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one thing about, the Russians and Chinese, you know, have been, you know, backing the regime in ways that I find rather upsetting, though, of course, it's no different than the U.S. backing Israel and Morocco and some of its allies when it violates international norms and kills innocent people. In fact, it's really interesting, despite all the self-righteous upset about the Chinese and Russian veto of that resolution a couple months ago, it was only the 8th Chinese veto and 17th Russian/Soviet veto since 1970, whereas during that same period, the United States has used its veto power 73 times. But in terms of the original question, I think that the more the movement is nonviolent, the more difficult a position it is for China and Russia to justify, you know, their continued support for the regime. An exclusively nonviolent movement, it would be very hard, in fact. But because of the armed struggle, they could say, oh, this is not government massacring its own people, it's a civil war, and why should the UN take sides in the civil war? Just the way that Hamas and Hezbollah, their use of violence, you know, is given the United States to justify for all sorts of massacres and oppression by the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that the so again, the more nonviolent the movement is, the more and more difficult it will be for the Russians and Chinese to continue supporting the regime. And this massacre the other day was just so horrific that even they are starting are admitting that there's something off here. So every time, you know, there is an effort of a ceasefire, every time Assad violates it, it politically it becomes more and more difficult for the Russians and Chinese to continue their support. And so I really think, again, especially if the movement can continue to be largely nonviolent, I think they are going to have to eventually crack the whip. They're going to, just like even in cases, you know, like Marcos in the Philippines and Saleh in Yemen, the United States finally had to come in and say, hey, guy, you know, you can't do this anymore. We're going to have to withdraw our support now. Even after many, many years of strong support and rationalizing for the dictatorship and everything else, you know, when they had mass movements, the U.S. had to, you know, finally see the writing on the wall. And I think in a similar way, the Chinese may have to do the same.
As I mentioned in the introduction, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, made reference to the possibility of military intervention. And what do you think of that? Do you think that there's any real possibility there, or is he just trying to frighten the regime?
Well, I think if anything, the regime likes the idea because, again, it defeats their nationalist rhetoric. The Obama administration has been getting a lot of pressure for military intervention. From the Republicans, John McCain in particular, but even from some Democrats like Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair John Kerry. Of course, McCain and Kerry are the same kind of people who support the invasion of Iraq, and we see how well that went.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I'm a as you know, a critic of many aspects of the Obama administration's Middle East policy. I got to give them credit for recognizing that you know, military intervention would probably be counterproductive. I know some people in the State Department who are working on this who actually know Syria pretty well, and these aren't pacifists. These aren't particularly progressive people by many measures. But again, they're pragmatic enough to do the cost benefit analysis and say, hey, the foreign military intervention would indeed play into Assad's hands, and this really should not be seen as a realistic option. What they have been doing and advocating are things like, smuggling in communication equipment for the nonviolent, protesters, and so they can, get the word out of these massacres, get visual images, do some coordination, that kind of thing. So the USAID has been very, limited to helping to on a very limited basis to help the nonviolent struggle. But as of now, they have been resisting the pressure to consider a military option.
So the U.S. hasn't been behind any of the arms that have been smuggled in?
No. As far as I can tell, no, they have not.
What countries have been?
Some of the Gulf states, Qatar, possibly the Saudis, others have have presumably been involved in that sort of thing. But as far as I can tell, the United States has not.
But these are U.S. arms that are making it in?
Yeah, presumably, since the United States is a major provider of armaments to the Qataris and Saudis and others.
Some on the left have, maybe a very fringe element, have suggested that Israel might be behind some of the unrest in Syria, and also that the U.S. government wanting the Syrian regime out might be in some way behind the rebellion there. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on these kinds of arguments are.
That's pretty silly, actually. There was some elements within the Bush administration that wanted to destabilize and ultimately bring down Assad. But ironically, the Israelis very much opposed it, as they do now, frankly, because even though Assad portrays himself as this intractable enemy of Israel, and even though part of Syrian territory is still under Israeli military occupation, they consider him very much of a stable status quo kind of leader. Whereas, there's a potential, particularly if the armed elements end up dominating, that Syria could find itself in the hands of some very hardline Sunni Islamists with Salafi influences that may be a much more destabilizing force in the region. Interestingly, the Palestinians, both the Fatah and the Palestinian Authority and the more moderate secular elements, as well as Hamas, have come out in support of the opposition in Syria. So the Palestinians are far more supportive of the opposition than the Israelis are. Also, it's interesting that the pro-democracy struggles that have fought U.S. dictatorships, including the ongoing struggle in Bahrain, and despite elements to portray the Syrian resistance as some kind of a Sunni fundamentalist movement and efforts to portray the Bahraini resistance as a Shiite fundamentalist movement, they have both publicly gone and expressed their solidarity with each other, because they both see themselves as legitimate majoritarian pro-democracy struggles and not the sectarian conflicts that the dictatorships are trying to portray them as being. And finally, I think it's a real insult to the Syrians who've been dying by the thousands in their struggle against this oppressive regime, that they would somehow blindly follow the dictates of Israel, the United States. The vast majority of Syrians don't like Israel, the United States, and for good reason. Israel's occupied large chunks of Syrian territory. Thousands of Syrians have died in wars against Israel. In fact, the United States has killed a large number of Syrians back during U.S. intervention in the 1980s, and the U.S. has put on these really hypocritical punitive sanctions against the regime, for allegedly doing a bunch of things that Israel and in Egypt, other U.S. allies, already do. This is just a it's really ridiculous. This is a genuinely popular movement, and it's degrading, even racist, I think, to imply that the people who are taking to the streets against their oppression are somehow puppets of foreign powers.
Some have argued, though, that there has been a lot less attention placed on, for example, the repression by the Bahrain government against pro-democracy demonstrators, and that Syria is getting a lot more attention in the mainstream media and in the U.S., and that the reason behind that is that the U.S. government wants to get rid of the Assad regime. So
this is nothing new. I mean, I remember back in the 1980s, there was a lot more attention to alleged repression by the leftist Sandinistas than there was the far, far greater repression by the right-wing Salvadoran junta. The media and government and others have always tended to jump on repression by regimes that we don't like by ignoring or downplaying repression by regimes we do like. There's nothing nothing new about that. I know I personally have written a fair amount about Bahrain and pointed out just this kind of double standard. But that doesn't make the pro-democracy movements themselves any more or less legitimate. I mean, if you're under an oppressive regime that's killing your people, you don't look to see who their foreign backers are or where they align themselves geopolitically. You're interested in freeing yourself from repression, and I think that's really the bottom line.
I'm a little curious what you think of the Assad regime blaming terrorists, including Al-Qaeda, for the massacres that have taken place throughout the uprising in the last 14 or 15 months. Is this just, them protecting themselves? I mean, there's still some question, apparently, from some news reports I've read, there's still some question of who was responsible for what happened in Hula, at least the people who came in on the ground and went house to house.
It's looking pretty clear that it was a Syrian regime, though I think I would not doubt that there are elements of the armed resistance provoked the initial attack in certain ways by violating the ceasefire themselves. And again, that's a reason I have one of the reasons I have problems with the armed resistance. But there's no question that the Syrian regime, in fact, has been responsible for the vast majority of the killings of civilians. Especially when you look at the first, 8 or 9 months of the uprising, when it was almost exclusively nonviolent, and even back then the regimes were saying this is Al Qaeda, these are terrorists, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And now that it's become, the armed wing of the resistance is becoming increasingly prominent. Of course, they're saying this even more. And there have been abuses, by the by the opposition, by the armed wing of the opposition, but these have been documented, by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others. But these same groups also point out correctly that the vast majority of the war crimes and human rights abuses are indeed coming from the regime.
Yes, and nothing like this. I mean, the kinds of abuses by the rebels have been things like massacring suspected, government supporters,
collaborators,
which I'm not condoning.
Those are violations. But just going in here and randomly massacring and hacking children, that kind of thing, that's definitely not their style.
It doesn't seem like it, The eyewitnesses are saying it was either government security forces, but most are saying it was a government-backed militia, correct?
Yes, yes. The government has been using various armed militia to do some of their dirtiest work, and the preliminary indications are indeed that was probably a part of it. But ultimately, of course, the government was responsible for arming and sending these guys in the first place.
So what you think we're likely to see in the coming days is just increased sanctions and pressure maybe from some of Syria's allies like Russia?
Syria's really isolated themselves. And especially, people say, well, why are we making these agreements? The regime just breaks them. And I can certainly understand that. But when the regime does break them, it isolates them further. It hurts their credibility further, and it usually has reduced the repression, at least to some degree, at least for some short period of time. Again, that's better than nothing. And so we shouldn't be naive about the regime. We certainly shouldn't trust the regime. But that doesn't mean that there can't continue to be diplomatic efforts and a push for negotiations. But ultimately, I think what the negotiations are going to have to do is, you know, negotiate a peaceful transfer of power to a wide variety of democratic opposition forces.
We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunes. He is one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action, and a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. I just want to finish with, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, I feel like a lot of us feel kind of helpless when things like this happen, and they're so horrifying, you know, to read about 49 children, you know, just mutilated. It's such a horrifying thing, and a lot of people just feel very helpless, and it seems like something, there's just very little we can do. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what ordinary people, what kinds of actions they can take, if anything, in response to something like this.
Well, I think, you know, part of it is the more you know, the more serious isolated the sooner the regime will be forced into negotiations to transfer power. I think that you know, one needs to, you know, both acknowledge the you know, the nature of that regime, and you know, so I think challenging those who try to rationalize for it, but also to recognize that the U.S. military intervention indeed would be counterproductive, would play into the regime's change, and to challenge that kind of talk as well. But also just to underscore that human rights are human rights, regardless of regime's relationship to the United States. And this goes both for, of course, the U.S. government, which gets all self-righteous about what's happening in Syria while, you know, backing other brutal regimes, but also elements of the so-called left who have to flip on the other extreme and say, well, if you're anti-U.S. and anti-imperialist, therefore you must be okay. We need to have one yardstick, you know, for human rights and stress that consistently. And frankly, one of the best things we could do for the Syrian people would be to challenge U.S. support for other dictatorships, because as long as the U.S. supports other dictatorships, they find elsewhere in talking about repression in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Stephen. I really appreciate it. Maybe you can just tell us how we can access your website and read more of your article.
Sure. I'm at www.stephenzunes.org. That's STEPHENZUNES. And I have scores of articles on U.S. Middle East policy and related issues, including a fair number on Syria, which you can find on that website.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
My pleasure.